Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Thank you for joining us. Today is June 16th. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. We really appreciate you joining us and sharing our radio station with us. I want to remind you that starting Monday, we're going to have Barry Prince take over Mondays. If he likes it, he's going to come on the next few weeks, see if he likes it. He has his own radio show called The Big Puzzle on another radio station, and he has agreed to take over Mondays for me. So if he likes it, I'll be on the air now from Tuesday through Friday. So just want to let you know what's coming up on Monday. Today we have with us a returning friend of our show, Chuck Johnson from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. I want to kind of get into it because, boy, is there a lot going on. So thanks, Chuck, for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be on again.
It's really awesome. Look, I asked you what's going on, and there is plenty going on. Why don't you tell us, why don't we talk about what you really wanted? You knew exactly what you wanted to say, so why don't you talk about what you want to talk about today?
Yeah, well, the one thing that I definitely feel we need to talk about is the increasing evidence of the capture of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission by the regulated, the utilities that run the nuclear power plants in the United States. And the latest evidence of that is the article that just came out 2 days ago in the Arizona Republic that the NRC allowed the Palos Verde nuclear power plant to operate one of its reactors for 57 days without an emergency backup generator. They had an explosion when they were testing their backup generator and fire, and it was destroyed. And then they were given two extensions of time to get it repaired and were not required to replace it or bring in a new generator. So this totally violates the concept that they supposedly follow, which is defense in depth. And it was exactly what happened in Japan. They didn't have enough defense in depth with the Fukushima reactor because when their power was knocked out by the earthquake and tsunami, and they went on emergency backup generators, and the emergency backup generators were flooded by the tsunami. Then they had nothing.
Wow.
So theoretically, if they'd had some sort of failure of either their water supply system or their electric, their main electric supply, they did not have a backup for 57 days. And this is outrageous. Wow. It was so outrageous because there were people in the NRC, other people who were aware of the situation, who were filing objections to this, and furiously and being denied. And eventually those people leaked the information to the Union of Concerned Scientists, who leaked it to the Arizona Republic newspaper.
Wow.
Which is how we found out about it. So it's just, to me, the latest example of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission bending its regulations to suit a utility. And I think it's becoming even more pronounced now because nuclear power is under such economic pressure from cheaper natural gas and renewables.
Yes.
They're trying to keep the nuclear power industry going, and they're willing to bend the safety rules to do it.
I think that speaks to this act, the H.R. 474, Interim Consolidated Storage Act of 2017. Daryl Issa introduced it. It has not passed, but we really have to stop it. They want to basically sell nuclear waste. It says it amends the Nuclear Waste Act of 1982 to authorize the Secretary of Energy, who's Rick Perry right now, to enter into contracts for certain high-level radioactive waste and spent nuclear fuel. Take title to certain high radioactive waste and spent nuclear fuel. Uh-huh. And make certain expenditures from the Nuclear Waste Fund. So to me, an indication of the gross negligence. That's kind of the culture right now.
Well, Congress has a lot of legislation that is not positive in the nuclear area, and it's, to some degree, it's been bipartisan. For example, yesterday, the Ways and Means Committee in the House passed an extension of the production tax credit to accommodate the reactors in Georgia and South Carolina that haven't been completed yet. The production tax credit that they're eligible for expires in 2020, and now it's become clear they aren't going to finish these reactors by then. So Earl Blumenauer, our congressman from Portland, from deep blue Portland, was a co-sponsor of that extension and talked about how we needed to have all carbon-free alternatives available. So this has become rhetoric among some of our Democratic representatives to promote nuclear energy as a carbon-free alternative.
That's what they're hearing. It's so ridiculous because nuclear is not carbon free from cradle to grave. It really does. Anybody with a brain in their head knows that it uses a lot of carbon. I mean, the nuclear power plants for 20 years are carbon free, but for another 150 years, you have to use a lot of carbon just to maintain them. That's why they want to sell the nuclear waste, though. They want to get rid of the waste.
Well, and there's another bill on the waste issue that probably is even more likely to pass than ISIS bill, and that's Shimkus. Representative Shimkus from Illinois has a bill that he's marking up now next week that will allow the reopening of Yucca Mountain, the research at Yucca Mountain. But also allow for what they call interim storage sites for high-level radioactive waste, because they realize Yucca Mountain's not going to happen anytime soon, and there's pressure at some of these reactor sites to get the high-level waste moved, and so they're looking for volunteer sites, probably in Texas or New Mexico, to quote, temporarily, end quote, take that waste and put it on a parking lot to take casks of spent nuclear fuel and leave it on a flat parking lot type of a structure.
That's a smart idea.
Yeah, well, anytime you move that stuff, it's a danger. I mean, the material itself is so highly dangerous. I don't think people really realize how dangerous it is. If you stood next to a fuel assembly that had just been moved out of a nuclear power plant. Within the first year, it would only take you 7 seconds to receive a lethal dose of radiation.
Seven seconds.
Kill you. Not from cancer, but, you know, just kill you from the radiation. 10 years later, it would have cooled down some, but that still would be lethal if you were exposed to it for over 2 minutes. You know, that's not really a very long time to receive a lethal dose. But that's after 10 years of cooling down. After 100 years of cooling down, you would still receive a lethal dose, but it would take you about 13 minutes standing next to that same fuel.
Oh, wow.
But that's 100 years later. So people, we don't run into materials that are like spent nuclear fuel in our normal everyday existence. So I think it's, when people hear that this is toxic waste, they think, yeah, I've got, you know, some toxic cleaners underneath my sink that I use from time to time if I have a particularly dirty job to do. No, this is not like that. You know, this is worse than anything you could think of. And that's why it's been so difficult to get at the cores at Fukushima, because this material in the core of a nuclear power plant stays impossibly radioactively and physically hot for a really long time. So if they can't get robots close enough to it to really even determine exactly where it is.
They have a new robot. I read about a new, it's a small robot. I think they said it's about 6 inches big. It floats on water. And so it's going to, like, I don't know how they plan on doing it, but they plan on sending it in to take a look. It's a new kind. I don't know how much it costs, but we'll see what this new one does. It's supposed to go in, and it should be able to withstand, I think they said, 2,000 sieverts. But at the center of those things, it's way hotter than 2,000 sieverts. So I don't know what they're thinking about. So,
well, I think they're trying to get things closer and closer. You know, they're obviously using this horrible experience to test out new robots.
And bioengineer humans. I think that's part of their plan. I swear, it's unconscionable. So what's going on in Hanford? I mean, is your ear to the ground on, I've been saying that I think Hanford, people have called me, and I think it's degraded to the point of falling apart. Like Heidi Lambert said this, that it's like whack-a-mole. They're going to pop one down, they're going to have an emergency, and then another one's going to happen. That it's just a disaster out there, that it's falling apart.
That's a great description, actually, whack-a-mole, because, and they Doug Shoup, who's in charge of some of the cleanup efforts out there for U.S. Department of Energy, just admitted exactly what you're saying, which is, he said, you know, these facilities are getting old and they're deteriorating, and we're not cleaning it up fast enough. We're going to have more situations like the collapsed tunnel and the debris that fell at the plutonium finishing plant that caused them to, you know, have to decontaminate part of the area there. They're cleaning up some really nasty facilities. That's part of it. I mean, the first one was an example of an old facility that they didn't have scheduled to do anything with, and they just hoped that tunnel would hold up. They don't have it on the schedule to even clean up the Purex plant or those tunnels until now. Now they're developing a plan for the tunnels, but that was further down the list. You know, plutonium finishing plant is on the list. They're almost done, you know, tearing it apart and trucking its various parts to different temporary and permanent dump sites. But it's, you know, it was where they were refining, taking the final stages of refining plutonium to ship on to Rocky Flats to create the buttons that would go into nuclear bombs. And so it was heavily contaminated. It's taken them about 5 years to you know, to plan and then tear apart this facility. And they've done it very slowly, methodically, and mostly have kept their workers safe. But it's such a hard thing to do that, you know, they had a screw up of some sort that allowed some workers and some area around there to get contaminated. And stuff like that's just going to keep happening. It's a nasty, nasty site. And we should remember that, you know, because the thing that people talk about, I mean, and this includes James Hansen and a number of the others who say, you know, this is not the spent fuel and nuclear reactors is not waste. I mean, we've hardly even used all the fissionable materials that's in that spent fuel. What we really need to do is set up systems where we can recycle that waste. Well, that's what they were doing at Hanford. They were recycling spent fuel. They were taking out the plutonium, not for reuse in commercial reactors, but for bombs. But it's the same basic principle, and it creates very dirty, contaminated waste streams that are hard to clean up. So, this blithe dismissal of spent nuclear fuel is, oh, it's not really a problem because we can just recycle it. No, it does not make the waste go away. Recycling adds to your waste stream and adds to the complexity of cleaning it all up. So anyway, soapbox. Well, I'll step off the soapbox for a moment.
Well, I want you to be on the soapbox because you know what? People do not understand. Like, this is part of the thing. This whole idea that nuclear is carbon free is a complete lie. It's a lie. It's not carbon free. And it ought to be part of the anti-coal, the anti-fossil fuel movement. The whole thing, that set of three options for energy ought to be phased out.
Well, I totally agree with that, but I have to say that it's still a lot less, even if you count uranium mining and the milling and everything else, it's less carbon intensive and significantly less carbon intensive.
Well, here we go again, back to this idea that you're
a gap.
You know what? In my view, that's ignoring what it does to the biota. I think it massively contributes to global warming. It doesn't directly produce carbon, right? Like, it doesn't exactly do that. Although it does emit some gases that does contribute to the carbon footprint thing. The biggest thing is that it destroys our environment, which is harming the biota, which is, we're like suffocating the earth with, you know, I read off the EPA that there was 500,000, I mean, that there were 15,000 uranium mines. I was doing some research for my final yesterday, and there are now, by the way, anybody who hasn't seen the government's website post Scott Pruitt on the EPA and the Bureau of Land Management, boy, does it look different. But on there, with abandoned uranium mines, they basically said, there's a page that says the extent of the problem and 500,000 abandoned uranium mines. There's 500,000 abandoned uranium mines.
In the United States?
Yes. It's right on the webpage.
That seems really unlikely. But yeah, I'll take a look.
I was like dumbfounded. I've been saying 15,000. That's what I read last year. This is the government Bureau of Land Management.gov. Literally, it said 500. My mouth fell open. I couldn't believe it. And they have them all listed.
We've got some in Oregon, Lakeview. There's mines in Lakeview, Oregon, uranium mines.
There's one big gaping hole. You can actually see it if anybody wants to look. And, you know, you can always identify uranium mines, abandoned uranium mines, because they make a big gaping hole in our planet. Like, you can see it on the Google Maps. It's not hard to find. So,
yeah, and up in the Spokane Reservation, there's another big uranium mine that, of course, they never really get properly cleaned up because they create such a mess you really can't clean them up, you know. It's a hole in Mother Earth, and what'll clean it up is time and a lot of it, unfortunately.
Well, so. You know what's interesting is I guess this is probably my soapbox, is I want people to start talking about nuclear in a rational way, because this concept that it is doesn't contribute to me, I think it's completely misses. This is where the environmental movement has gone wrong. I think it's a fundamental oversight. And this is why, like, we're not having the right kinds of conversations about the waste and the harm, the urgency. We have an urgency on our planet. Like, at Hanford, I mean, what are they doing up there at Hanford? They're trying to fix it while people are making lots and lots of money. I mean, you know, that Richland is one of the fastest growing towns in America, and you can make a good income working there.
Yeah, you put yourself at risk if you go out and work at the site. But yeah, that's exactly right. And they've wasted a lot of money out there. They've done some good cleanup along the river, and they've even dug out some of the source material, the hexavalent chromium that was getting into the river. And that's really good, because that's a carcinogen, you know. But then they've wasted so far about, I guess it's $12 billion on the waste vitrification plant that was a bad design, that people criticized that design from day one, and they ignored it. And the contractors have just made a bundle with this extended rollout of this supposed plant that's going to solidify all that liquid tank waste. And you know, now they're having to create pretreatment plants in order to treat that waste so that you don't have explosions once they actually turn on the vitrification plant.
Can you explain how that plant works? Because I thought that that was a great idea. I thought that was going along swimmingly. So can you explain, give us kind of a little bit of an overview? We have some time. How does that work, and what's it really doing then? Like, what are they doing with it? That's a lot of money to waste.
Well, the idea, and this has been done successfully in other places, was to take the liquid tank waste and solidify it by mixing it with glass so that you can store it more easily and control its composition a little more, because you had settling going on inside of these tanks, so they were constantly having to stir it up in order to keep it from settling in, and possibly as happened in Russia years ago, have a explosion, a criticality explosion. they had one of those in the 50s at a tank that's similar to some of these ones that they have at Hanford.
Wow.
The problem is that this waste came from a bunch of different reactors, and it was they used different processes for getting the plutonium and uranium out of it to reuse. And so they ended up with waste that was quite different from tank to tank, with different isotopes, with different half-lives, with different concentrations of each. And the waste is not uniform, and that's what makes it hard to put through one single plant and solidify it, because it behaves differently depending upon what's in each tank.
Wow.
And there are 177 tanks. So what they're doing now, it was a design build project where they, you know, people who are in a big hurry to do something, a lot of times they'll start building it before they're finished with the design.
That was my question. Didn't they think of this beforehand? But no, they didn't, because they sort of built it as they went. It's kind of like you go to South America and you see a lot of homes, like they're sort of half built and people are living there. Like, they build their homes around them. As they get the money, they'll put up another wall.
Right. And you see this in third world countries where they'll have rebar sticking out of the top of the house because they're going to put another floor on it eventually, you know.
Right.
This was like that. I mean, we're going to work out some of the additional details, but let's get started on it now because we want to get this thing going. Well, that caused them to sink a bunch of money into it. And then you get that that reaction that often happens once you've put a lot of money into something. You think, well, we have to make it work now. You know, we've already put $5 billion into it. You know, now we're up to $12 billion. So, and they keep having whistleblowers who say, if you turn this thing on, you could have a hydrogen explosion and blow it all to pieces.
Oh my gosh, really?
If you turn this thing on, you could have a criticality explosion. You could, you know, actually, it could have a nuclear reaction and blow it all to hell and send stuff, radioactive materials everywhere. So, and then they, of course, immediately start treating those whistleblowers like dirt. And the latest one, Walt Hamasaitis, just got a multi-million dollar settlement. So he actually has ended up doing well, and good for him. But mostly whistleblowers, you know.
How long did he have to fight them?
Oh, you know, I mean, I think it took him probably about eight or 10 years to get the settlement. But I mean, it totally derailed his career, but now he's pretty wealthy. So that's good.
What was his settlement? How much did he get?
I think it was around $8 or $10 million or something like that.
So,
I can't
remember.
I'm sure his attorney got a chunk of it.
Yeah, they usually take 40% or something like that.
Yeah. So anyway, so what they're doing now, I think they're on to something. They may actually get this vitrification plant working, because they're involved in setting up a series of pre-treatment plants where they separate out. Right now, they're separating out low activity waste, which is easier to solidify, easier to handle, and they're reducing the volume that way. And you know, as time goes on, maybe what they'll be able to do, hopefully, is reduce the amount of material that has to go through the vit plant. Because one of the problems with it, the way it's designed, is there's a section of it that humans can't go into. So if anything fails in it, once it's turned on, then the plant's toast. You know, you can't reuse it, and you can't use it anymore if things break down. So reducing the volume and the amount of stuff that has to go through it is a good idea, because it has to work. It has to work perfectly once it's turned on. It looks like within the next couple of years, we'll have some glass logs of what they call low activity waste, less hot radioactive material. And we will have actually reduced some of the volume in the tanks. Hopefully they can then continue to pump. They're pumping out the leaking tanks and putting it into double walled tanks that a couple of which have already sprung small leaks, but they're still within the second wall. So they're better than the single walled tanks anyway. And they're planning to have this whole thing done by 2050 or something like that. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous, the time scale. I mean, if I'm still alive, then I'll be 95 years old. So I'm not really counting on seeing them finish this project.
I think they have I don't think they have any intention of fixing any of it. To me, this is just a money tank. You know, they just suck money out of us and try to keep it from exploding. I don't think they're taking the waste management of this very seriously at all.
I would have agreed with you prior to these new ways for solidifying some of it, because it was going on that they were designing and building, but very slowly, and then they'd stop for a while because, oh, gee, you know, we have internal people that say that this will explode, so maybe we better look at that. And then they were in this stasis for about a decade, really, and that's all they did. And it wasn't until, I think the guy's name's Kevin Smith, but a guy from Savannah River came there, and they started developing this pretreatment plan, that they actually seem to have some forward motion now for treating some of the waste anyway. So we'll see.
Do you think that the whistleblower, how do you say his last name? Thomasaitis?
Thomasaitis.
Yeah. So do you think what he went through, do you think it actually helped at Hanford? Do you think that they actually changed and did things a little bit differently because he spoke up?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They, you know, you always want to punish the messenger if you're a big institution and you don't care about outcomes, but you do care about hierarchy. So they definitely did that. But at the same time, he had blown the whistle. And they were thinking, okay, you know, what if he's right? He's probably right. You know, I guess maybe we can't get away with just continuing to build this the way we were planning to do it. So that's it. And there were private conversations that we were not privy to, you know, probably with some of the senators who were providing funding and others who were saying, you know what, you guys need to get your act together. But that didn't, and they took away the bonuses for that year from Bechtel, who's been the main contractor. You know, 1 year, you know, it's like boo hoo hoo. They're paid well enough as it is without the bonuses. Anyway, it's tiring to see the level of corruption on something that's as dangerous and important as this.
It is, you know, actually. It's so outrageous. This is why there's people out there ranting and raving, freaking out and calling names and getting mad because nobody's jumping up and down. And this is the thing. People are jumping up and down. People are taking action. But I think I talked to you after I did that democracy school, and I'm still very excited about community rights. I think this is really the way to go. Now that I'm out for summer, I'm going to lean into it. I think that's our way out of stopping these people, is for us to get our community rights. Because then we can actually stop them and, you know, make them spend some money. And actually, I don't really understand the culture of going to work in a place that causes so much. And I think this is the issue. I think we touched on it earlier when we were talking about James Hansen. They really believe that the waste is just not that harmful. They really believe that it's not that bad, that the waste, while it's dangerous if it gets out, it's in containers, and it's not that bad, and that it can't really hurt the water supply. That's just, you know.
Well, Hansen did a study with, actually it was another person did a study, but Hansen put his name on it at Columbia. And about, I don't know, 3 years ago, something like that, comparing the number of deaths caused by coal versus nuclear. And the only thing that he counted for nuclear was the release in the normal operation of nuclear power plants, of the amount of radionuclides that they do in their normal operation. And then in terms of coal, they counted mining and everything else. You know, they basically made it look as bad for coal as they possibly could, and as good for nuclear as they possibly could. And then came up with a result that's pretty predictable, which is that the coal is a hell of a lot more dangerous to humans than
what's really amazing
including the normal releases of a coal plant release more radionuclides than the normal releases of a nuclear plant, which is, you know, it's a little shaky, but it's, you know, there's some truth to that, because they don't, there's radioactivity in coal, in mined coal that gets burned. And
yeah, well, that's the thing that they don't talk about. I mean, part of what makes coal so really toxic is the uranium tailings, the mining tailings that are highly radioactive. Like, that's the thing that just blows me away. It's not like it's a separate issue.
That's true. Yeah, the issues are related. You know, anytime you're doing mining, you're going to be opening up the earth to a variety of toxins, including radioactive toxins. So
it's the mining tailings, and the mining tailings are really what they did the studies. I mean, that's what they did the studies on in the late 50s, and that's why they changed a lot of different things. And so, but it's been an interesting way that they've been able to manipulate this and separate the two issues, and as if nuclear is not hard, as if there's waste, like, oh, we're just waiting to figure out what to do with it. So it sounds like Hansen believes that this waste is just waiting to, they're working on ways to use it as new energy. In other words, it's not nuclear waste. They just plan on putting it into another container and using that nuclear energy.
Well, basically what it is that he met a scientist who was involved in the EBR-2 reactor in Idaho, which is a breeder reactor, liquid sodium cooled reactor that runs, you know, can run on plutonium, can run on a variety of things. And they were planning to use that as sort of the model for the closed loop cycle for nuclear power. Originally, back in the 50s and 60s, the theory was that there wasn't that much uranium out there, and that we're going to build a lot of nuclear plants. So if we're going to run them into the future, we needed to be able to extract the fissionable materials from the waste that was produced in running a reactor and reuse it. And they wanted to design reactors that would actually produce more fuel than they used. And that's what this reactor does. Because it produces so much plutonium, it actually produces more fissionable material than it started out with. And so then all you have to do is extract that fissionable material from the other byproducts. What they don't say is that the other byproducts are really, really dangerous. There's cesium, strontium, you know, all the nasty things that happen that get released when you have a nuclear accident are present inside a spent fuel, naturally. And you have to do something with them. And that's what a place like Hanford is about. There was a commercial facility called West Valley in Western New York that was set up to reprocess commercially in the 60s. And there was, it ran for a very short time before it broke down, and it had a number of breakdowns. And it also didn't, because the fuel was more, that came from it was more expensive than mined uranium fuel. It didn't really develop a market. So it got shut down. Now it's a waste dump site. It's sort of a little mini Hanford, along some creeks that feed into it's south of Buffalo, and it's next to a Native American reservation. I'm blanking on their name. It's one of the Senecas. It's one of the seven tribes of the Iroquois. It goes right into their creek. The waste does, and then into Lake Ontario, I guess it must be. Or is it Lake Erie? I can't remember. But so it's been a cleanup site. At one point, they were trying to get permission to take some of the waste from it to Hanford to dump, and we blocked that from happening. It's not well known, but this is what James Hansen doesn't put in his book and doesn't seem to understand, is that it's not a clean process to reuse the fissionable materials in one of these breeder reactors. You got to do something to get that, to separate out that fissionable material that you can reuse, and well, you end up with a lot of nasty waste byproducts.
This is what I think. Like, I even take it a step. I mean, I just said this earlier. It's not just that it's nasty. It kills all biota. It kills life. This Musso, I think it was, went to Chernobyl. I think that's the name of the man that did this study that I read. There is no, but he found no life in the dirt in Chernobyl. So this is what we have to understand. For them to say that does not contribute to global climate change, to the carbon footprint, is misses the big picture of what really nuclear does, because it suffocates the system. It's like putting a big plastic bag over someone's face and expecting them to be able to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I just, it really, it just blows me away. They don't get it. So
this, well, this, it's a nasty, it's poison power. I mean, that's what, that's, that was the title of John Gottman's book, Poison Power.
I read that on my YouTube channel, you know, like I read it chapter by chapter. I read the whole thing. It took me about 2 months. I read about 15, 20 minutes a day.
Huh.
Yeah. And so I had a lot of people that actually heard that book and I'm actually reading Carl Grossman's book right now. I sort of stopped last week when I hit finals week, but I'm going to go back at it actually today. I'm reading Carl Grossman's book that's available online for free. It's called Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. He put in a brand new addendum. It was like a 20, 25 page addendum after Fukushima. And him and the information in there was so important that he talked to the publishers of it and said, hey, we want to give the book away for free. And for technical reasons, they had to list it and call it a sample. But it's on his website if you want to read it. It's amazing information about the background of nuclear history and what we're being told and what we're not being told. It is shocking.
Oh, that sounds really good. I thank you for telling me about that. I respect him a lot. I think he's great.
He was on yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, his interviews. We have very thoughtful, frank interviews, and I love his thinking because he brings me, you know, I mean, you've known me long enough. I tend to get a little bit wild-eyed, you know what I mean? I'm like, yeah, I get all sidetracked because to me, things seem logical, right? So, like, I go on logic, but, you know, there's a certain level of you got to stay on track if you want to get your point across, so.
Well, he's a honest to God, legit scientist, you know, I'm glad we've got some of those guys on our side.
I can't believe how much is going on though. How much is like up there in Hanford completely falling apart. It's business as usual, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, and they're admitting it and they're basically saying, you know, with Trump cutting our budget further, we're going to be able to get even less done. They're spending about $500 million just maintaining the roads and the fire trucks and all the rest of the infrastructure at the place. Because it's, you know, Hanford Reservation's huge. It's a huge, you know, it's as big as Rhode Island or something like that. You know, I mean, it's like a big, big area.
Isn't it 400 square acres? I think off the top of my head, I remember reading it was 400 square acres or something like that.
So if they want to make any progress with the cleanup, you know, they already start with a baseline of, you know, they need to prevent wildfires from happening there. They had one that almost would have overrun the site if they hadn't been prepared recently. And, you know, they got all kinds of stuff they need to do just to maintain the site. And then, you know, to get the cleanup done on top of it, they need money. They need a couple billion dollars a year. And they're getting, last year they got about $1 billion. For the Office of River Protection.
Well, this is how big it is. 586 square miles. So it's big, 586 square miles. And one day it would be a good long drive to go across the whole reservation.
Oh, no, you can drive across it pretty fast, really. But it's big. I mean, and there are a lot of decaying facilities, as we said. And if you want to keep them from falling apart, then you got to spend money to do that. Mm-hmm. And you won't even necessarily anticipate everything that might fall apart. Like they sort of knew that the that that tunnel was vulnerable because they used wood timbers in it. And they estimated that it should last another, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years. You know, I think they made that estimate about 10 or 20 years ago. So, and then they
that's always
really
what
revisit
they say,
it.
Actually. That's always what they say. Oh, and about 10, that's why they keep kicking the can down the road. This is what they do. This is their method. They don't have any answers. Instead of saying, you know what, we're really strapped. We have no idea. We know we're going to need money for a long time. They just use that 10 years from now. They just keep telling us 10 years, 10 years, 5 years, 10 years.
Exactly. So before we get off the call here, I want to do a quick update on what's happening with small modular reactors and the CPS. Columbia Generating Station nuclear plant. Start with the Columbia Generating Station. It is right now in refueling outage. If they stay on schedule, it'll be out for a little less than a week still. But I have not been hearing reports on how it's going. So we'll see. They're trying to keep it to 40 days out. They're trying to not do any extra clean fixing of anything. They like military operations, they name their outages. This one's called Inside the Box, because they're basically trying not to think outside of the box. They're trying to just do the basics and get it back online as quickly as possible. It's because they've been criticized by us and others with being expensive. And so every moment they're shut down and aren't generating power, all they're doing is costing money. They're not generating any income. So they want to get it back up online as quickly as possible. But of course, that means that maybe they're not fixing things that need to be fixed that may break later on. You know, and that's a concern. So we'll see. We'll find out in a week or so whether or not they've met their deadline. They're hoping that if they do, their ratings versus all the rest of the plants in the United States will start to go up. Because right now they're in the bottom quarter of plants that operate in the United States. They stopped publicizing that. They claim that the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations is tying their hands and won't allow them to tell anyone, even their own board, what the what their ratings are. Which, of course, they were happy to tell people when their ratings were good, but since their ratings turned sour about,
they're
three
not
years
even
ago,
telling their own board what their ratings are.
Yeah, because it's a public entity. You know, Energy Northwest is publicly owned utilities. It's subject to Freedom of Information Act requests and everything else. So, so it's, you know, if they tell them it's public information and they're claiming that they can't even tell their own board how they rate.
Wow.
it's outrageous.
That's not good.
And this very passive board has now come to accept this. And it's very discouraging how passive the board of directors is for Energy Northwest. So, okay. So that's kind of the current status there. The small modular reactor bill has been killed. You were there to testify against it. Thank you very much, along with a number of other people. It was an attempt to change Oregon's law to allow small modular reactors to be built. The state law currently says that any nuclear power plant cannot be built in the state until there's a permanent disposal site for the high-level radioactive waste that it generates. And it has to be voted on by the statewide, by the people. And this would have exempted small modular reactors from that. Passed the Senate before we noticed it was even in existence. They were doing a stealth campaign. There was no publicity of it. And,
well, they submitted it after the closure of normal business. Every senator, that's how it got put in. That's what they explained there. After the closure of normal business, because the session had closed, every senator can add a bill, and he put that through, that sponsoring senator who put it through.
Senator Boquist.
Right.
But it's not the session
it
hasn't
fail.
Closed it, but the deadline for submitting them
closes. Yes.
Except for two priority bills. And we should have kept looking, but we didn't. But we did manage to catch it. We got help from the mainstream environmental community, which was very encouraging, very heartening. We got Oregon League of Conservation Voters was really helpful. Sierra Club was really helpful.
That's why it takes everybody to pay attention, because we can't just trust. That's the sad part about it, is we can't just trust that they'll go, oh, yeah, you're right, this isn't good. But because of the James Hansen kind of mentality, he's always out there saying it's clean. This isn't really waste. This is potential energy for the future. So what's the problem?
Right. That's it. And that is what we're up against in the Oregon legislature, is some of that thinking. And the people have been going down to New Scale, getting propagandized, not understanding that this is the same waste that they that are produced in larger reactors, or believing that this waste isn't really a problem because it's been minimized by these nuclear power officials. And, we're going to need to do some work, especially with the Senate, where it passed last year. After this legislative session's over, we're going to need to spend some time talking to our senators and explaining to them that this is dangerous and they need to prove themselves in dealing with this waste before we build any more. And I don't think they can, but it's a really reasonable offer. And
when you talk to them, Chuck, remind them, it's not like this is an industry who has taken care and really, we're not talking about an industry with a high reputation for good. They have really been bad managers of this. New York City don't forget, New York City is leaking tritium into its water supply on a regular basis.
You're talking about the Indian Point reactors.
Yes. I mean, this is the thing. They tend to forget, they act like it's not that bad that we're leaking radioactive nuclides into our groundwater. That's a serious issue.
Yeah.
And I hope that you remind them of that, because really we need advocates to say this to, and I think what we should do is bring them documentation of the oncology rates around where nuclear power plants are.
Well, there was going to be a study that the NRC killed the funding for. They were going to try to do the same study that had been done in Germany and France and Great Britain to see if there were certain types of cancer that were more common around nuclear plant sites, and it was killed internally during the last year of the Obama administration, it's just really disappointing, because it was a relatively inexpensive, I think it was $7 million in their budget. That's not a lot of money. And it got killed. They're going to have the National Academy of Sciences do the study. And they basically, their excuse was, well, we already know that it's safe and we already know what the result is. So, why would we waste money doing that?
It's actually the opposite.
The
I mean, this is the thing. I don't know why we have to keep beating the dead monkey, because honestly, we have had tests. We've had tests. I mean, Arthur Tamplin, Linus Pauling, and John Goffman did studies that unequivocally showed living near these facilities, living near the uranium tailings, living near mining tailings. I mean, there's so much. We know what it does. We don't really need studies. If they want us to, I mean, we can do studies because it's easy, because the results are going to be identical to what they were in the 1950s. Nuclear waste kills people.
Right. Right on.
I know, so, man. So here we are. I don't know about you, Chuck, but it does make me, it gets me going. It makes me angry, and I have to really work on not being angry. But I don't want to be an anti-nuke activist for 30, 40 years. I want our government to take this stuff seriously, and the murderers and the liars who are the liars that are saying it's murder, it is ecocide, it's genocide. And they have got to just stop with this idiotic talk that it's not harmful.
Well, you know, I didn't want to. I'm 60, about to turn 62 here shortly, and I was working on this stuff when I was in college. So, you know, good luck in not working on this for 40 years.
Well, I mean, but, I guess when you look at it in the long run, this stuff's going to last 100,000 years. So if we really do, we are going to have to really pay attention to it, all of our generations from here on out. And it's not going to just be the nuclear industry. It's going to have to be all of us paying attention to it to keep
right.
our children
this
safe.
This is part of our job as human beings is to, you know, we're in the Anthropocene age now. We're changing our world and in ways that will be noticeable to future archaeologists, if any exist. You know, it's our job. This is one of the areas where we're failing on the job. One area is, you know, and burning a lot of fossil fuels. Another is the nuclear age. And people who want to make you choose between those two are, to my mind, not thinking sanely. I mean, this is the argument of, well, okay, you got a guy pointing a gun at you. Would you rather have him shoot you in the head or in the stomach? You know, come on, he's going to shoot you. You know, that's a given. Would you rather be shot in the head or in the stomach?
Ask Congressman Scalise. People will say, well, he's been shot in the hip. He's not hit that bad. He's very, very badly damaged. He's going to have several surgeries.
Right. And so the point is, hey, you know what? Let's put the gun away.
Uh-huh.
You know, let's not do either one. How about that? How about that idea?
And the fact is, we don't need it. Actually, I've been reading articles. It's coming out. Like the favor, the economic, it doesn't make sense. Economically, it's a losing situation now because of the waste. But also, there's other alternatives that are becoming cheaper and that don't produce the waste. And it's ridiculous. So, you know, they're just going to follow the money. So, Chuck, we have about
That's
2 minutes left.
Capitalism is our friend right now. You know, if it's actually free market capitalism is our friend with renewables right now. It's fascinating.
I don't think free market is really our friend. I'm going to balk against that one. Well,
it's not our friend generally, but I'm saying in terms of price, right now, Lonnie, the price of solar and wind is coming down, and it's due to mass production and all of those things that have caused so many problems. So that's also something for us to think about. My friend Mark Rabinowitz is constantly warning about how overconsumption is such a huge part of the problem, and we can't just grow our way out of the problem with wind and solar if we just keep using resources the way we're using them.
Right.
You know,
there is no infinite supply. Right. The whole concept of infinite supply is just a losing situation. Well, Chuck, thank you for joining us. We have about 30 seconds left. I just wanted to remind people that they can go to Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. You can Google that in to find out more about what Chuck's organization and what they do and where they're at. And I really appreciate the work you're doing, Chuck. Thank you so much.
That's great. I appreciate you too, Lonnie. Thank you. Great that you do this show.
Well, I'm glad that we can. You guys put your courage feet on, take action, pay attention to the nuclear facilities in your area, and let's change the conversation because we got to change it up. I'll talk to you guys on Monday. Actually, not Monday, Tuesday.